Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I am Matt.
And today we are answering your listener questions.
Right, Joel, we're going to answer listener questions this episode. And before we kind of share what some of those are, I just want to say thank you to all of our listeners out there who send us questions. They're kind of entrusting us with their lives a little bit, you know, at least with their money. I guess they don't necessarily have to do what we say. Well, but there's still, I feel, a certain weight of responsibility. And I want to say thank you to our listeners for that.
Yeah, sure. I think, you know, you and I, we have a desire to provide the best advice we possibly can. At the same time, too, we tell everybody that submits a question, make sure you're doing your due diligence as well. And I think one of those things is to seek our advice, but there are other places to turn as well. Matt and I, we're always going to do our absolute best to give the advice that what we would do with our money, or, you know, what we think is the best way forward for you. But at the same time, our word is not gold. We're fallible humans too. So
totally. All right. So on that note, we have five listener questions like we always do on our every other Monday episode. And a few of those are becoming a financial coach, hiring a personal car shopper, what to do there, as well as some HSA issues that one of our listeners is running into. She's got some questions there, plus two other questions, man, that we're going to get to. But before we get to our listener questions this episode, let's talk about something. You know that I did this, but I don't think I've gotten your opinion yet as to whether or not you think this was a good idea or not. So recently, I chopped the legs off of the vanity, the sink that's in the girls' bathroom. We've got, you know, our girls, they all share this bathroom.
Three daughters.
And the problem is, man, in this bathroom, the sink was so incredibly tall. Like it was maybe 3 inches taller than a standard sink. And then in addition to that, it was really deep.
Sounds perfect for someone my height.
For you, I should have just donated it to your household. But what that meant for us is that like Kate, she has a hard time even using the sink because it's just kind of awkward because it's so high. Kate's kind of short. She's like the opposite of you. And so finally, I was like, you know what? Why do we have multiple stools pulled up to this thing? Why not make this sink more usable for the kids? And so I was like, you know what? It's a Saturday. I'm going to just tackle this project. Grab the Sawzall, a little multi-tool saw as well to kind of get some clean cuts on the front. And I literally chopped off about a foot from all four legs of this vanity, and I dropped it down, man, and it's comical how low it is, but the utility and the usability that the girls now have, like they can all just run up to it, wash their hands. They're not fighting over the stools. They're able to brush their teeth more easily. They're able to wash their hands more easily. And so it's promoting better hygiene. So there's a win.
Better hygiene is priceless too, by the way.
Dude, it is. Because think about it. That probably saves us maybe some trips to the doctor if they're washing their hands more. So, but what are your thoughts on the fact that I literally just chopped the legs off this pretty nice vanity? You know, it's got like a nice marble top, but I just totally hacked it.
No, I think it's an awesome move, dude. I think one, it just makes it easier for your kids, and it makes it, yeah, more fun to brush your teeth, wash your hands, whatever. And at the same time, you're planning on being in your house for a really, really long time. And so what's a new vanity cost? Like $250, something like that, right?
And depends on how nice you want to go, buddy.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Exactly. But I think so many people think about everything they do to their home only in terms of resale value. Mm. And you have to think about it in terms of livability. And so, yeah, like when
what does this do for you right now?
When we're making decisions about what we want to do to our house, like it's not that we don't consider resale value at all, but we're also thinking, you know what, we plan and think we're going to be in this house for the next 30 years. That's how much we love it. And so the decisions we make are far less about resale value, and they're more about how does our family function in this space and what do we want to do to make it the most appealing for us to live in right now. And so I think it's actually helpful to make decisions based on that and less about resale value, especially if you know you're going to be in that house for a long time.
Yeah, it has a big impact on our life. And in the end, like say, I mean, we're not planning to move. You know, we're like you guys, we're here forever, man. Bury us in the backyard, that kind of thing. But even if we were going to sell it, like you said, $250, it wouldn't take much money at all to be like, okay, we got to get rid of the ridiculous pre-K sink.
Right.
You know, like, because that's what it feels like. It feels like you're walking into like a kindergarten classroom where everything's like shin height or like knee height at most. It's ridiculous looking, in particular too, because it's like really wide. And so like you lower that thing and it looks so short and squatty. But cool. Sounds like you think it was a frugal move, not a cheap move, huh?
Yeah, I totally do. I think, yeah, whatever makes your house a better place to live, especially if you're planning on being there a long time, go for it. And I think it looks good, and your girl seemed to love it. So
it's all about the caulk, because the edge of the sink, you know, the countertop goes all the way up to the wall there. And so you just kind of put a nice bead of caulk right there, smooth it out. It looks like it's been like that forever. I'll actually maybe share a picture on our Instagram account so folks can maybe judge for themselves if they think it's stupid or not.
Maybe a picture of me trying to wash my hands in this incredibly short
sink. You standing next to that thing would be amazing.
All right, we'll do it. We'll do it. All right, well, let's get on to the beer that we're having on this episode. This one's called Apparitional Disintegration. Of course, it's by Burial Brewing Company, because they're the only ones that come up with names that are that complex. And yeah, this is a double IPA. And man, these guys are out of Asheville, North Carolina. They make incredible beers. I'm looking forward to having this one on the show with you today, my friend.
Yeah, that's right, man. But before we dive into the questions, anybody who has never submitted a question before, we want you to know that you can easily record a voice memo on your phone. And then all you have to do is email that file to us. We'd be happy to consider that and hopefully answer your question on an upcoming Ask How to Money episode.
Yeah. Simple instructions are at howtomoney.com/ask. And Matt, let's get to our first question. And this is from a listener who's submitting a question for the second time.
Hi guys, it's Kayleen again from Burbank, California. I had another question for you. It's in regards to hiring a personal shopper to buy a car for you. Now I'm in the market to buy a new car, and or a used car actually, and I've been looking online at the possibility of hiring one of these personal shoppers to do all the heavy lifting for me, because frankly, I am not educated enough or feel confident enough to go in and haggle with the dealer or get the car checked out, just do all the legwork. I'm currently without a car, and during COVID, I have a lack of resources or friends, anyone willing to go drive around from dealer to dealer with me and haggle for a new car. So I was considering hiring one of these personal shoppers. I don't have a lot of money, but if it's reasonable, it just might be worth my time to hire someone to do all of this for me. I could test drive it, sign all the paperwork, and be done with it. Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, Kayleen, we love that you are submitting another question. You know, that's always cool with us. And I'm glad to hear, too, that you're looking at a used car versus a new car. I think there are some individuals who might prefer and value having a brand new car. If that's one of the things, if that's your craft beer equivalent, then we say, hey, more power to you if you're in a solid financial position. But for most other folks, yeah, used is totally the way to go. And honestly, you know, we can't speak from personal experience as to whether a particular car shopper is going to be worth it, but we can definitely speak to buying a used car. That's how Joel and I roll. We think that you can do it without a personal shopper. You know, it's really not all that difficult. And it's an important thing to do well, because like, you don't want to make a purchase that's super large like that, right? That takes a lot of funds, that could become a money pit, you know, a decision that could leave you stranded, as well as maybe just being a source of frustration. So let's discuss how you can buy a used car and how it is that you can get a good one.
Yeah, let's do it, Matt. A personal car shopper, I've never hired one, and I don't really know what that entails, but I think we can give Kayleen the confidence to go out there and shop for a used car on her own, right?
Yeah.
And one thing she mentioned was haggling and visiting dealership lots. And it's interesting, I think a lot of people still have that mindset of that's how you go about buying a used car.
Yeah, I don't want to do that either.
Right, exactly. And I think one of the first things we have to tell Kayleen is that's not what you have to do. That's not the process. And in fact, that is a process that some people do. In fact, one of my good friends, Matt, one time she bought a truck, she literally had her friend drop her off at the dealership lot. And she was at the mercy of the dealer. She had to buy something that day to be able to drive away from the lot.
That's a bad situation to put yourself in. It's just like, hey, could you please throw me a life raft as I'm sinking here?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, I'm going to negotiate some.
But she needed a car.
Don't have much choice here.
To get home, right?
Wow. And
yeah, so that's just a bad way to do it. So let's talk about the kind of modern way or other ways that we would suggest going about buying a used car. And in particular, what matters is kind of what companies you choose to go with when you're looking at used cars. And two great companies right now that have kind of changed the game when it comes to car buying are CarMax and Carvana. And one of the ways that they've changed the game is that they will bring the car that you're interested in to you. Carvana actually that kind of pioneered this. And when they launched their service, they instituted a 7-day no questions asked return policy, which made people feel a lot more comfortable about buying a car online and then having it delivered. CarMax followed suit, and so buying a used car online has just never really been easier. There are other ways to buy a car, right? I mean, I bought great cars via Craigslist throughout the years.
Good old Craigslist.
But it sounds like, you know, Kayleen doesn't necessarily have a car right now to be able to get around and look at cars from private owners. And so because of that, having the car delivered is just going to make your life so much easier right now. So I would say start shopping on those two sites and see what you can find. See if you can find a car that's going to meet your needs with one of the companies that's going to make it easy for you.
Yeah. And again, one of the things that's so great about CarMax and Carvana is the fact that you don't have to haggle. You get online, you see the price, there's no negotiating. So that issue is kind of already out of the way.
And there's none of like the, well, let me go talk to my manager about that and exactly. See what I can do.
Dude, yeah, I would be terrible at playing that game. I feel like I'm very good at playing the game of, let me just buy this online. obviously, that doesn't allow for maybe as much flexibility, but I think a lot of these companies are in a way that eliminates some of those additional costs and fees because there are a lot less middlemen that you're having to deal with, right? But I think some of the issues that a lot of people have when it comes to purchasing a used car is they just don't know anything about cars, right? Like cars are really complicated these days. I feel like you have to be part mechanical engineer and part like computer scientist because with all the technology that goes into cars. And that's really intimidating. I'm a pretty handy guy, but like I don't know anything about cars. But that's the thing. You don't need to know anything about cars. You just need to know where to take your car to ensure that you're getting something good, right? So if you do decide to go in the direction of, you know, going with Carvana or CarMax, make sure that you use that 7-day trial period in order to have that vehicle inspected by a mechanic. I actually was able to do this myself. Gosh, it's been maybe four years ago now that we purchased our Honda minivan from Carvana. They've got lots of great pictures online, so you get to see like literally every angle. You get to tour the inside of it with real pictures from that actual vehicle. And so we went ahead and bought it. We showed up. I test drove it around. Like you took me there and you're like, hey, let's go for a ride. You know, so we drove around in it, which is pretty cool. And then I was like, all right, cool. We'll take it. Drove home, but then I didn't take Carvana's word that this is a super solid vehicle. I took it to a well-respected Honda car mechanic, and he was able to find out that, hey, the timing belt on this thing needs to be changed. There's some issues. And so that was something I was able to point out to Carvana. And dude, guess what? They actually took care of that repair for me. That was like, gosh, maybe $1,100 for that repair that I didn't have to foot. Had I not done that, and had I gotten out of the period where Carvana would have taken care of that for me, you know, say even 6 months later, I think I would have been in a situation where it would have left, you know, a sour taste in my mouth where I wouldn't have been happy with that entire process. But use those periods of time to your advantage.
Yeah, the 7-day trial period is just awesome for so many reasons. I mean, because even if you just don't really love the car or you're like, man, it's not the color red I thought it was. You can return it and it's fine. And so, yeah, I love that they've instituted that. It does inspire a lot of confidence in the buying process.
Yeah, just make sure that you don't go over the mileage cap. Sometimes they include those. You know, that way you don't like get it and drive it like across the country and then back within 6 days. Like
right.
Little cannonball run.
A little coast to coast. Make it happen.
It's like, oh, I don't like it anymore. Sorry, I put 3,000 miles on it.
Right, right. But yeah, and I think, Matt, you're spot on. Having that vehicle checked out by a mechanic just ensures that you're buying something great. And you can let the seller know, hey, actually, you need to fix this before I'm willing to buy it. And so, yeah, it allows you to negotiate on those grounds. Also, too, Kayleen, don't forget to think about financing before you make your purchase. Right? If you purchase a car through a site like Carvana or CarMax, you could also grab financing through their sites. They make it pretty easy. That's obviously the most convenient route to go. But if you do that, you might not get the lowest rate. So shop rates with a local credit union or two as well. And you should be able to do that from your home also, be able to do that online. You want to factor in the total cost of car ownership, and that includes what you're paying for that loan that you're going to take out. Ultimately, Matt and I are fans of paying cash for a vehicle, right? Like that's the sweet spot. Only buying what you can totally afford to pay
right
out
now.
Of pocket. Yeah, exactly. and that's what we've prioritized for ourselves. But if you are taking out a loan, make sure to shop for that loan and make sure to prioritize getting a low interest rate for the vehicle, hopefully, that you're going to own for, you know, the next 5 or 10 years. So best of luck, Kayleen, on doing it yourself, being your own personal car shopper. That's the direction we would encourage you to head in. All right, Matt, let's get to some more questions. And right after the break, we're going to take one from a listener who lives overseas.
All right, we are back. Let's get back to listener questions. And we have a question here that is from Germany.
Hi, Joel and Matt. I really enjoyed your show and appreciate your thoughts about how best to handle money. My name is Jacob Kuhn, and I'm a U.S. missionary living in Germany. Because of some bad decisions in my past, I have quite a bit of credit card debt. Problem is, I almost always hear about getting out of debt by picking up a side hustle. If I lived in the U.S., I know of a good amount of jobs that I could do and easily pick up, but my German visa doesn't allow me to work outside of the ministry where I work. So my question is, well, kind of twofold. One, do you have any resources to help me budget better so I don't continue to accumulate debt? But then also, do you have any suggestions for side hustles that I can do online? I'm a former teacher and an avid modern board gamer. If that helps with suggestions, you can find me a side hustle about board games. I'll be excited. That's my main two questions, but I also have a couple beer suggestions for you. I'm originally from Toledo, Ohio, and we have a brewery called Ernest Brew Works. And I would suggest getting Crunchy Hippie or any of the varieties that they make of Crunchy Hippie. It's a really good brown ale. Thanks for your help.
Jacob, thanks for your question, man. And thanks for the beer suggestions, too. We're always up for beer suggestions because I'm trying to try them all before I die, Matt. I know it's like a physical impossibility.
It's not
though.
Possible. It's like a Pokemon game. You gotta try them all.
Right, right. All right, let's get on to Jacob's question. Jacob, let's talk about, you know, how you can stretch your resources while you're living abroad and how you can potentially earn more money too. You're in an interesting situation. So Matt and I will do our best to speak to it from over here in the States. A side hustle is one way to make extra money in order to pay down debt, but it's also important to reduce your expenses. And I gotta imagine that's tough to do on a missionary salary. I don't think I've ever met a missionary who was like just rolling in the dough, Matt. That's just not, you know, typically.
If they are, they normally have something else going on, maybe kind of under the table, right?
maybe so.
Maybe some MLM action going on that we wouldn't approve of.
Right. Maybe. I don't know. But I would say there's a good chance that Jacob's not getting paid a whole lot as a missionary, right? To begin with. And so, yeah, finding things to cut is pretty difficult. And Jacob, don't join an MLM to make more money.
It's like, I'm already eating rice and beans too. Like, I can't make any more cuts.
Right. But I would say too, you do have to stop the accumulation of debt. And Jacob, I would suggest in your situation, if you know you're relying on credit cards in order to fund your lifestyle, that's something that you have to stop immediately. And so I would suggest, you know, you can actually literally freeze your credit cards and put them in a plastic baggie with water and put them in the freezer. Make them hard to get to. Whatever it takes in order to curb your spending and stop the use of buying things on credit that you can't afford to pay off at the end of the month, I would say that's a really important thing to prioritize right now.
Yeah, and hopefully, you know, those decisions are in Jacob's past. They're not, you know, anything that he's continuing at the moment. But a lot of, Joel, you know, what you mentioned too about kind of reducing your expenses, like it comes down to making sure you've got a solid budget in place, you know? And so to that end, we would recommend something like YNAB, which is You Need a Budget. Even though, this is a software that costs money, which sounds like the opposite of what we should be recommending, Jacob. But it's a great resource to help you to develop and stick to a budget. And sometimes, like having a little bit of skin in the game, that allows just enough of a commitment for you to maybe follow through with it versus it being something that's free, right?
Right. Although you can try it free for 34 days.
That's true. 34 days, which has always kind of been odd. You know, like why not 31 days? Like right. A typical month, but like 34 days. But what's great about YNAB, you know, is the behavior modification techniques and teaching that they offer in combination with just a really solid platform, just the software that they offer folks. I mean, it's just a really impressive combination. And so if you are looking for some, you know, just some practical tools to help you to get on the path of making your money behave in addition to yourself, well, then that's something, yeah, we would recommend for you.
Yeah, YNAB rocks. It's helped so many people out. And Jacob, it's definitely worth looking into if you're having trouble sticking to a budget. I think YNAB is the best thing for people who have a difficult time actually following through on a budget. Let's talk about side hustles too. Again, yep. Matt, Jacob's in an interesting spot because he lives in Germany. And if your visa, Jacob, doesn't allow you to work outside of the ministry that you're working in, well, we wouldn't want you to get in trouble and lose that visa. But if you're able to do some online side hustles and it won't put that visa in jeopardy, then we suggest going in that direction. Check out a site called sidehustle.com. It's spelled a little differently, SIDEHUSL.com.
No vowels needed.
It's
hip.
Oh, wait, one. There's two. No, there's three. There's a lot of vowels, actually.
Well, sometimes you just got to exclude some of those vowels, and all of a sudden, it's something that I'm interested in.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know why it works that way, but I'm like, oh, no vowels. I must drink that. You know, like Dissolver, we had them recently.
Yeah.
We just excluded a couple of vowels, and all of a sudden, I'm interested.
Yep.
I'm a sucker.
So sidehustle.com has just an awesome amount of side hustles that they post and they review, and so it'll help you understand whether or not that's going to work for you or the pay is going to work for you. And then there's also another site called flexjobs.com, which has postings of different job offerings that are super flexible, where you can do from anywhere at almost any time. And so, yeah, I would say go to one of those two sites. And if that's not going to put your visa in jeopardy, doing some side hustle work that you can find in one of those places is a great way to go.
Yeah. And Jacob, but that being said, if you know, depending on your specific visa, if you are not able to actually work right now to earn any additional money, regardless if it's online or in person, there's nothing keeping you from dreaming about what a potential side hustle or a side business, what that might be once you were to come back to the States, right? And so there is a lot of work that can go into creating your own business now, where guess what? You don't earn any money. And granted, that doesn't help your situation like in the moment. But if you're going to be back in the States in, you know, a few years, it would be amazing to have a giant head start on something that you are really excited to launch once you return back to the States, right? You mentioned board games. Maybe that's designing and beginning to create that board game, but you don't actually launch it until you get back into the States, right?
Or launching that YouTube channel, explaining the best board games that you love.
Boom, you go. Yeah, yeah. He mentioned that that's something that he loves.
You know, instead of reading the instructions for board games, Matt, I go first to YouTube.
Because
someone explains it and shows it on the board for me.
And
instead
you'd rather
of me,
do that.
Yeah, I'd rather do that than like, you know, read it in black and white.
Or if there was an audiobook version of the instructions, I think you'd probably do that first, because I know you love that.
I do. I love audiobooks.
But some friends of ours, they are both sommeliers. They're really into wine. They've worked in the wine industry for forever. And they recently launched a wine board game. It's called Somnify. I actually need to pick a copy up. But they have had incredible success getting that off the ground. A lot of people are interested in just fun, new, different board games that are out there. In particular, things that we can do at home. Because you know what? Like entertainment out in the world, getting lost in these large crowds, that's not something a lot of folks are into these days.
Right, yeah. I would also suggest if you're into wine-based board games, Viticulture is another great one. That's awesome, man.
He made a beer recommendation for us. You are making a board game recommendation for Jacob.
Exactly.
Full circle.
And Jacob, too, if your debt is out of control, let's say the total is more than you make annually, it's going to be tough to pay off that debt if it's gotten to just that extreme of a point. So if that's the case, we would recommend going to see a not-for-profit budget counselor via the NFCC or Money Management International. They can help you in ways that you won't be able to help yourself, right? And so you can even do that online right now, getting counseling over the internet. And so, yeah, if it's gotten to be that difficult of a situation for you, seeking out that sort of expert advice and help is going to be crucial in helping you not only tend to some of the debt problems that have popped up, but then creating a solid budget and a plan for the future. So, yeah, check those resources out as well.
Yeah, so Jacob, thanks so much for your question. And yeah, best of luck to you. Joel, our next question comes from a listener in California, and she's got a double header for us about investing as well as taxes.
Hi, Matt. Hi, Joel. My name is Elizabeth, and I'm from California. I just wanted to say that I'm so grateful to have stumbled upon your podcast. My family and my friends have never really talked about finances or investing or anything like that, and so I feel like I'm really late to the game and I'm trying to catch up, but listening to your podcast has helped me understand so much, so thank you for making this journey a little bit easier. My question is in regards to the cost basis method selection that I need to make for my index funds. I'm assuming that this is important to choose, but I'm not really sure what it all means. I was hoping you could help me out. If there is time, I did have one more question. I want to take advantage of an HSA. However, it seems that the triple tax advantage doesn't really apply here in California, unfortunately. I'm just curious about your thoughts on starting an HSA here. And if I move to a different state upon retirement, will I be able to avoid the taxes? Might be a stupid question, but thought I'd ask it anyway. Thank you so much.
Elizabeth, thanks for your question. I'm so glad the show's been helpful. Sounds like your family is actually normal because most families don't talk about personal finance, really.
It's not a topic that comes up around the table, but, you know, when you're having dinner.
You and I, we're hoping to create a new normal, right? We want people to talk
Absolutely.
About money a whole lot more openly. And by the way, too, you know, a lot of people like to rake themselves over the coals and they say, well, I'm getting started really late. And Elizabeth, I don't know how old you are, but it doesn't sound like that's the case. Like
she doesn't sound 75.
Right,
you know?
Exactly.
Like I would say that might be too late to get started with your personal finances. I don't think that's the case here.
No, it's kind of hard to get started at that point in time.
Yeah.
You're right, yeah. But Elizabeth, you got plenty of time and it sounds like you're on the right track. So let's get to kind of the particulars of your question. When it comes to your investments, let's talk about, you mentioned the cost basis method. And cost basis is an important thing to know for tax purposes, particularly if you're investing in a brokerage account. And this is a brokerage account, not a traditional retirement account like a 401k or an IRA. We'll talk about that in just a second. But let's define what cost basis means. It's essentially the purchase price for an investable asset or a property. So it's a little nerdy. An example might help us figure this out. Matt, let's say you bought an investment property for
$200,000,
right?
Oh, I like it. Yeah,
yeah,
okay.
And then you sell it 10 years down the road for $300,000.
All right.
Yeah.
So return.
Yeah, not bad. So in order to calculate your taxable capital gains, you subtract the basis, which is what you paid, the original $200,000, from the sale price, which is $300,000. And that leaves you with a total return of, Matt?
$100,000.
Very good. Very good. You're good at math.
I was thinking about the beer. So,
yeah, that's the gain on the property. And because of that, you're going to owe tax on the amount of that gain on the $100,000. And the same is true of the gain of an index fund inside of a brokerage account. If you buy at, let's say, $15 a share and sell at $20 a share, you're going to owe tax on the gains, which is the $5 that would
be
the difference.
Almost beat you to
you're almost there.
Right. So that's cost basis and that's how that works, right? But this is less of a consideration when you're talking about money in retirement funds, right? In a retirement account. If you are investing in a traditional or a Roth IRA or in a workplace sponsored retirement account, you don't need to worry about cost basis. And the reason is that nearly all of those contributions are deductible at the time that they're made, at least for a traditional IRA, right? So when you start taking distributions in retirement, the full amounts of each distribution is subject to tax, not just the gain. Those gains are taxed then at that point as income, not technically as capital gains. And of course, if we're talking about a Roth IRA here, it's just the opposite, right? You pay tax on all of that money up front. That money is invested and grows over the years. And then once you make those withdrawals, and once they're qualified, you don't pay any tax.
Yeah, so hopefully that was a clear explanation. I know it's not the easiest thing to understand, but hopefully that helps where you are. And Elizabeth, you also asked about your HSA. And interestingly enough, you live in one of two states that don't seem to like HSAs that much. California and New Jersey are literally the only two states that don't give tax breaks to people who put money in their HSA. And they don't really seem to have a good reason for it either.
Well, those are expensive states. You know, I feel like there's a lot to pay for in California these days in particular, right?
Still, don't hate on the HSA,
infrastructure.
Guys.
Same thing with New Jersey. A lot of roads and highways and turnpikes and
that's
stuff.
That's true. That's true. Turnpikes. A lot of turnpikes. And Matt, I saw that actually in February, California, there was a bill introduced that would have allowed state residents to get the tax break for money they put in an HSA. But due to the pandemic, that bill has been sidelined. We'll see what happens. Maybe in the future, Californians will have that same benefit. But for right now, you don't get the delightful state tax benefit if you live in one of those two places.
But she does get the federal tax benefit.
Totally.
Right? And so this doesn't mean, Elizabeth, that you don't need to, you know, put money in an HSA. It's still a pretty good idea. You know, even if it can be a bit of a headache to track your HSA contributions and gains, you will still receive that triple tax advantage on the federal level at the very least. So HSA for the win, still, just a little bit less so in California and New Jersey. All right, Joe, we've got a couple more questions, and you know what? We're going to get to both of those right after this break.
All right, we're back from the break. We got a couple more questions to get to on this episode, and the next one, Matt, I really dig this one. It's someone that wants to use their financial knowledge to help other people.
Hi, Matt and Joel. This is Justin from New Jersey. I was thinking about becoming a financial coach and have found that there are a lot of different certifications for this. I don't want a CFP, but don't really understand the differences between the rest of them. I found at least 5 other coaching certifications, and I'm sure that there are more. If you could help me understand the differences between some of these certifications out there, and when certain ones make more sense than others. Some of the certifications I found include the FCMT, CPCF, CFEI, AFC, and the FFC. Thanks for the help, guys.
Matt, I'm not going to lie. Those sound like college football conference conferences, right?
As well as the SEC.
And the ACC, and maybe the Big 12.
It is kind of confusing, right? There are a lot of different designations out there. I mean, he said there's probably a bunch. I literally think it's in the hundreds, as far as I know. But yeah, Justin, this is a very interesting question, but I love that you do want to help people with their money. And because of, you know, all the different certifications that are out there, including the ones you mentioned, it's hard to know like what it actually means when someone calls themselves a financial coach, right? The same can be true of a financial advisor. Although, you know, the certification is way more important if you're going to be letting someone handle your money themselves versus just receiving advice from that person. In that case, they would just be a coach. Financial coaches and financial advisors really kind of meet some different personal financial needs for their clients.
Yeah, Matt. I mean, oftentimes when someone refers to themselves as a financial coach, it just means that they've actually been writing about money on a blog, or they've started offering one-on-one coaching sessions.
Yeah, that's us.
Right, you know? Yeah.
We like to talk about it. We're really interested in it. We want to help people, but we're not handling the retirement accounts of individuals.
Right, you know? Exactly.
That's not something I would feel comfortable with at this point in time.
And they don't have any certification to back it up, right? That they don't have a degree or letters behind their name stating that they have earned something that provides proof of like a accomplishment of a course or something like that, right? And oftentimes, Matt, the reason people do that and the reason that you and I create this podcast is because they're passionate about the subject of money. They're passionate about helping others with their money. Many of the people that offer financial coaching services are people that have just an incredible debt payoff story. They've paid off $60,000, $70,000, $100,000 plus worth of debt, and they've gotten so entrenched in the personal finance space through blogging about their own life and their history with money and the things that they've learned that they want to offer that as help to others. And I love that the financial coaching space is really interesting because of that, but it also does make it a little hard for the person seeking advice to know what they're getting into. And that's where formal accreditation like can be helpful if you're trying to get into like the legit financial coaching world.
Yeah. So let's go ahead and talk about some of those acronyms, you know, some of those different designations. We think that it's great and you know, that it can provide some peace of mind for your future clients. I'm partial to the AFC accreditation, the Accredited Financial Counselor, but the CPFC is also another solid option that seems to be well respected out there. For both of these, the costs are reasonable for the education that you'll be receiving on both fronts. And those certifications are great to point to when you're talking to potential clients. It's good marketing, and it's a way to show your clients how you are committed to personal finance. And also, you know, since you are listening to a money podcast, I'm sure that you are doing this, but make sure that to continue to pursue money education, right? Through books or podcasts, like that's just going to be helpful to continue to hone those skills.
Yeah, Justin, not only will you learn a lot of helpful things in some of those courses as you attempt that financial coach accreditation, it will also allow your future clients to have a little more confidence in the advice that you have to offer. Yeah. But at the same time, it's not an end-all be-all. And I would suggest, too, for our listeners who are looking for a financial coach, you have to be really careful out there because it is kind of a Wild West space. And like I said earlier, most of these people out there in that space have a great heart and want to help people with their finances. But sometimes the heart and the knowledge are not quite aligned. And so, Justin, I do think getting that accreditation can be helpful to kind of align both of those things. And it can give you a little more credibility in the space.
Yeah. And from a business standpoint, too, like, again, these initials, all these letters after your name, they are nice, but they are not going to be able to replace you doing good work year after year where you're getting personal referrals, folks who can personally vouch for you. And that just takes time. That takes years of doing the good work, you know, fighting the good fight. Also, too, you know, while we're talking about just other things when it comes to business, you know, we would suggest as you kind of continue down this path to look at a fee-only structure, you know, similar to the way that we want people to pay their financial advisor if they decide to go that route. Upfront pricing provides transparency, and it'll help your clients to know that there isn't a conflict of interest, right? You're not necessarily trying to sell them something where you're going to get a pretty large kickback from that. you could charge by the hour, or, you know, just kind of have that upfront multi-session total cost, you know, basically where they're able to know what things are going to cost upfront. There's no, you know, nothing is hidden. Nothing is going to surprise them. And two, I guess we're kind of going down this trail of offering advice that you didn't necessarily ask for, but
I love doing that, especially with my friends, my family, they love it too.
But I'm thinking about marketing, right? Like when it comes to marketing your services, consider, you know, like a blog or a podcast, something like even like Joel and I do here. Having a solid website that goes a long ways as well, whether that's through WordPress or Wix or Squarespace, all those are going to be inexpensive and easy ways to kind of get up and running.
Yeah, I think, Justin, as you're thinking through what it looks like to become a financial coach, part of it's accreditation. Part of it is building a website. I mean, there's all these things that you can do to enhance your credibility. Something like Matt suggested, creating a podcast, the more you can put your voice out there so that people can get access to a little bit of free education, then they'll know what they're in for when it comes to that more strenuous financial coaching session where you're providing even more insight and even more in-depth counseling. And so, yeah, I think that can be a way to offer your services, the tip of the iceberg for free in order to gain clients. So, yeah, you got to think about all those things as you're starting this business, but best of luck to you, man. All right, Matt, let's get to our last question of this episode. This one comes from a listener who is wondering how the CARES Act affects how he approaches his 401k right now.
Hey, Matt and Joel, my name's Kevin, and I'm from Denver, Colorado. I have a question for you pertaining to what are the best options for a 401k rollover. So I had a 401k with a previous company. I've recently got a new job and actually doesn't have a 401k contribution anymore. So my account is kind of just, it's growing, luckily, because of the rise in the stock market, but I'm still getting fees and stuff like that. And I want to just try to figure out if I should either leave it in that 401k account or roll it over to maybe an IRA or take the money out and do some other things with it. I called the record keeping company for the 401k and they said that I could roll it over to another account, maybe another institution, probably Vanguard would be my option, for a $50 fee. Or with the CARES Act right now, I could actually take the money out. The distribution fee is waived at that point, and all I would have to do is take taxes. So wanted to get your take on what would be the best option, leaving it in the 401k that I'm currently with, rolling it over to an IRA and paying the fee, or maybe even doing the CARES Act and just paying the taxes now. Thanks, guys. Really enjoying the show.
Well, Kevin, if those are your options, you want to go with option B. Let's just cut to the chase, right? But no, like you do not want to take your money out of that retirement account. You know, even without that 10% penalty, you want to avoid paying taxes on that money. Although I guess, you know, if you are considering rolling it over to a Roth, get ready to pay those taxes regardless. But the bigger downside is not having your nest egg continuing to see returns for decades within your retirement account. You know, that option, honestly, should probably be removed from consideration here.
No, obliterated.
Obliterated. And you said there's a fee associated with that, $50. That $50 distribution fee is going to be totally worth it in order to, you know, to be able to keep that money invested for a long time to come. And you'll likely be paying lower fees for years as well by making that switch. And so that's certainly, that shouldn't be a barrier to you moving that money to a lower cost brokerage house.
Yeah, Matt, we're not fans of tapping the retirement account early, even in a year like 2020, in which that typical 10% penalty is waived. It just still doesn't make sense because you're missing out on long-term returns that you'd otherwise have by keeping that money invested for the long haul.
Yeah, I think the only situation where we would say, okay, it might be okay to do that is if you had an alternate investment in mind, right?
Yeah, but, or you literally have to put food on the table or a roof over your head, right? Like in case of drastic extreme circumstances, that's where it's okay to take money out of your retirement account. Most people, they're not in that position of having to decide between those two things.
Exactly. And Kevin didn't sound like he had necessarily something in mind. Like he didn't have a property lined up that he knew he was going to pounce on, you know? And so a lot of it kind of comes down to behavior, because if you know that you're going to take that money out and do something really smart with it, then we would say that, like, okay, yeah, that's something to consider. But in your case, it sounds like you getting your hands on that money, it could just become maybe a larger temptation, and that's something that you don't want to put yourself in.
Right. Yeah, totally. All right, let's talk a little bit more about fees too, Matt. When we're talking about rolling over funds from a workplace retirement account into an individual retirement account, then that's something that we really need to consider. Depending on what company your 401k is currently with, well, you'll likely have access to cheaper funds with a company like Vanguard, Fidelity, or Schwab. There are others too that are great and low cost. And whoever you go with, you'll want to initiate what's called a trustee-to-trustee transfer. You don't want a check put in your hands, because if you do, the clock starts ticking and you could find that you've got a tax issue on your hands. But prioritizing moving your money from the 401k where it currently is to an IRA or Roth IRA with a company that prioritizes hyper low fees is going to ensure that your money is working best for you for the decades to come.
So Kevin, let's talk about how to go about actually doing this, right? Reach out to whichever low-cost company that you dig and get the ball rolling. You know, the transfer is going to be pretty easy and seamless. Reach out to whatever new company that you want to go with. Give them the details on your current 401k account provider, and they will handle the rest. It's pretty chill. They're going to initiate that trustee-to-trustee transfer. That money is never going to enter your account. There's not going to be any clocks ticking. You're going to be completely safe. And like we've mentioned earlier on, best of all, that money is going to continue to grow for decades to come. If I were in your position, that's exactly what I would do.
Yeah, Matt, one of the biggest money mistakes people make is taking money out of a workplace retirement account early, whether it's a 401k loan, whether it's a hardship withdrawal, or whether it's 2020. And the CARES Act says if you've had any sort of financial impact on your life from COVID, you can take money out without paying the penalty. And in all of those instances, it makes it easier for us to take money that we've essentially slotted for our future selves, slotted for retirement, and start to use it up now. And that really comes back to bite a whole lot of people when they start to reach their older years, because they haven't had that money compounding for decades. They decided to use it up earlier in their life. So we would suggest leave it where it is, right?
Yeah, yeah. We don't need these escape clauses tempting us to depart us with our future dollars.
Exactly.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so Kevin, best of luck to you, and we hope that your retirement nest egg continues to grow for decades to come. So Joel, let's go ahead and shift gears. Let's get back to the beer. This episode, you and I each had an Apparitional Disintegration, which is a double IPA from Burial up in Asheville. This is one of the breweries that Kate and I visited while we were up there for a little trip recently. And this is one of the beers that we brought back for you and I to have on the show, man. What were your thoughts on this one?
I feel like while I was drinking this, there was much rejoicing in my mouth. I was just so happy. It was so good. It
was a nerd. Rejoicing in your mouth.
I feel like the hop presence was just so good. It was sweet, but it was the right kind of sweet. Mm. It was like perfectly balanced. And so, yeah, I mean, I don't really know what else to say about this beer except for the fact that this is right in my IPA wheelhouse. And
yeah,
pretty much every IPA Burial makes typically is. They just make awesome, awesome beers. So, yeah, man, really, really dug this one.
Yeah, in particular, these specialty Tallboy IPAs that they make, you know, like their standard stuff is pretty good, the stuff you can buy in six packs. But if you can get your hands on some of these four packs that are 16 ounces each, man, these are such great beers. I'm with you. This one in particular, it was mashed with like oats and wheat. I feel like it kind of gave it a paler, kind of lighter color. And I feel like it almost kind of gave it a kind of a wheatier finish as well, right? So it's a little bit drier, a little bit chewier on the tail end a little bit. But I'm with you. This is a really fantastic beer. I'm glad you and I got to each have one of these while we did one of our favorite things, which is talk about money. And that's going to be it for this episode, man. Listeners can find our show notes up on our website at howtomoney.com. We'll make sure to reference any of the different resources that we mentioned during this episode.
Yeah, and if you have a money question that you'd love Matt and I to tackle on a future episode, we would love to hear it. And it's so simple for you to send your question over our way. Just go to howtomoney.com/ask and follow the simple instructions there. In 3 minutes time, you'll have a MP3 file right in our email inbox. And hopefully we can answer your question on an upcoming episode. So Matt, that's going to do it for this episode. Until next time, best friends out.
Best friends out.